Well, welcome everybody to our next Nexus webinar. I'm super excited to have Will Mancini joining us. We've been using his material for a really long time. 5-6 years ago, I got introduced helping plant one of our churches in Loveland, Colorado. Just got introduced to the vision frame, and just so many light bulbs just started coming on of just being able to hang a lot of this visionary language of what is mission, what is vision, all these different things. And so, Through the years, we've just been able to upgrade some of our training. I've been able to be certified and just get trained under Will over the last several years, and being able to really just deliver this material a little bit better. But recently, Will's kind of wrote a new book called Future Church, and kind of directing and moving kind of in a prequel setting of what Church Unique is and God Dreams is, and moving into to what that looks like. So first of all, let me just say thank you so much, Will, for joining us. It's so good to have you, man.
Yeah. Oh, man, Andrew, always great to be with you, and excited to be with those connected to your network today.
Awesome. Well, if you would just kind of give us a reasoning behind this idea of future church. So you wrote Church Unique early 2000s, kind of came up with God Dreams 2015, 2016 as an updated version of that. And now as we turn into another decade looking at ministry and life and what that looks like, what was the reasoning behind the need for a prequel to that content?
Yeah, great question. There's several threads that were at play for me. One was I had, you know, Lyle Schaller was a distant mentor, didn't get a lot of time with him individually, but he would teach that between 15 and 20 years, if you've consulted that long, you'll probably want to reset your toolbox. And I was thinking a little bit about that, 2017, 18. The other thread, and most importantly, two things were happening for me, the signs that change was coming. One is that I believe in, you know, around 2015 would be the mile marker. During that year, one of the posts that took off that I wrote that actually Kerry Newhoff would take up, like in one of his first couple of podcasts, was the trend that our most committed people are gonna start attending church less and less. And some of our best ministry models were experiencing that dynamic. And I think the design of how we did church, I think that's the year I would signal that we were seeing how the church had a lower value proposition to the believer. And I'll unpack that a little bit more. So to me, there was design issues in the air. Like, are we really delivering on, you know, the mission, if you will, to the everyday disciple? The most like apparent one for me, what these are, these threads that are emerging, you know, reset the consulting toolbox. Maybe the design of our ministries is not as good as we think. But the biggest thing for me was I was able to look back over now, you know, over 15 years, you know, hitting, you know, way past the 10,000 hour mark of facilitation, you know, maybe almost lapping that number. And I was real, I could acknowledge with a new, self-awareness that I had done vision framing processes with churches, and some of them, you know, maybe the low 20%, maybe, you know, kind of put clients in buckets of thirds in terms of how their outcomes were, you know, how they would do long-term. And I realized there was too many churches that were better at articulating the disciple-making results that they weren't getting. It's like I didn't want the vision frame to be a marketing exercise. I wanted it to be, you know, a disciple making, you know, exercise. And so with all those things happening, I remember in February of 2016, I woke up in the middle of the night and jotted down seven ideas that would become the seven laws of real church growth, which is, you know, the subtitle to, you know, to the Future Church book. But that's the threat. In the end, the way that I'm going to name the problem in Future Church, so put all that together, you know, it's, I believe, and this was all, Andrew, as you know, before COVID. So like, in fact, this book, I sent this book to the publisher March 8th, 2020, 1 week before we're going to start closing our churches. So I was anticipating the fault line of 2020, which COVID just dramatically accelerated and made obvious for everybody. But the problem, all that culminated in naming the problem is this. Functional Great Commission in North America too many times has become go into all the world and make more worship attenders, baptizing them in the name of small groups and teaching them to volunteer a few hours a month. And I'm like, that's not what Jesus gave his life for. And that's not our ultimate calling. So worship, small groups, and serving are important elements, but that's not the mission of Jesus.
Yeah, no, that's good. I think I was going back through your material with the Future Church book this week, and just recalibrating is what it feels like. A lot of church leaders, a lot of church networks, and different people have really done. And our director at Nexus, Phil Claycomb, has done a great job of that. And you know, just introducing us to just materials by either like a Dan Grider and Starfish Movement, or Roy Moran's material with the spent matches and things of that nature. And so just really getting back to a fundamental understanding of, we need to not just play church, get together every Sunday and just play church, but really, really do the deep work and understanding that. And so you introduce a tool in the book that we've used a little bit in the Church Unique process, probably haven't really doubled down on it the way that you do in Future Church, but being able to introduce the upper room and the lower room. Can you maybe draw for us a little picture of what that looks like? And I'd like to bring some of that into our context as well.
Yeah, absolutely. So that's as you said, Andrew, we've used this before. And what I, you know, actually in this tool, we'll introduce the language of lower room and upper room identity. And I almost called Future Church, upper room leadership, or the church of the upper room. So that's how big of a master tool this is. And as you've seen before, what we do simply is do a little figure, you know, drawing of a house with two floors on it. And we acknowledge that when people come into the church, they're coming in on the first floor. And what we're asking the question is, why does this person who comes into your church, they get connected relationally, however they're engaged, why do they call your church home? And we're using the upper room, lower room to suggest that there are two fundamental places of connection. And I like to ask the question, what emotionally connects people to your church? And so we say there's four common things in the lower room: the place itself, the personality of the staff, you know, usually the senior pastor. There's programs happening, obviously. And then there are people, there are friends, and there's a vibe to the place and the relationships in the place. And what we're saying is that, you know, we want every church to have a great lower room. We want these things to be attractive, dynamic, well thought through, but that there's a problem if this is the only place of connection, this lower room area. And we can quickly imagine that a healthy church, you know, is going to be, these things are going to change over time. These are concrete things, places change, people come and go, or, you know, leaders come and go, programs, you know, need to be updated and tweaked and so forth. And then people, these are good things. They're not the ultimate things. And so there's a lot of ways to talk about this lower room identity, but I ultimately like to call it, you know, this is a place of provision. So it's provision. It's for the vision. It's stuff God gives the church to accomplish its mission, hopefully, but too many of the times it's all we have. And so we ask the question, you know, how do you get folks up into this place called the upper room? And we would simply call this purpose, and to kind of follow along with the P language. But what we're really talking about here is your unique disciple-making vision and that gospel impact dream that you have. And of course, all the tools that come along with that in the vision frame, in the horizon storyline, the 1414 in the vision frame. So we're suggesting that God really, you know, designed the movement where you get excited about, you know, the mission of Jesus. You get excited about a local family of believers having a dream for impact. You get excited about, you know, values and, you know, the outcomes, the character and competencies of Jesus that we're aiming at. And like, that stuff is so much more meaningful than just, you know, the color of the carpet, you know, a guy, I like to hear his style of teaching, et cetera, but that people can't experience this upper room until it's named well. And as you know, Andrew, so many pastors are just, you know, it's complex, messy work. We're moving at the speed of, you know, 100 miles an hour, and we just don't take the time to articulate, clarify, discern, articulate, and skillfully communicate this, you know, on a daily basis. So people can't really catch the vision, if you will. And so this just asks the question, what is the motivation of your current group of people who you're serving, who are following you as a church leader? And what is the current, you know, gravity of the lower room versus the opportunity and numbers of people in the upper room? And, you know, two quick layers as we kind of put this foundational picture forward. One layer is just imagine an 8-year-old boy or girl. If you ask them what they want most for their life, every answer will be tangible. You know, my daughter was giving me this Lego bracelet this morning. I got in late last night, and, you know, we're getting ready to go on a trip to see my next grandchild, my second grandchild being born. And she's loading all her precious, you know, her little pink pony and her little white fluffy dog. And like, what do you want most it's going to be tangible, electric scooter, Xbox, whatever. Ask the parents of an 8-year-old child, what do you want most for your child? Every answer will be intangible. They will have this intuitive, it's not a matter of like, quote, you know, spiritual maturity. It's just a human thing. Like a mature person is going to say, I want acceptance for you. I want you to know God and walk with him. I want you to have self-confidence and understand your gifting, these kinds of things. So it's just super basic that we see this in all of life. You see it, another lens that's so important is Jesus's ministry. You know, feeding the 5,000 men, which is easily 15 to 20,000 men, women, and children. I mean, this was a lower room place for Jesus's ministry. You know, in John chapter 6, Jesus just turns on some heavy cryptic teaching. He's talking about being the bread of life. And he finally says, and you know, John 6:66, hey, if you don't, you know, eat my flesh and drink my blood, you can't have eternal life. And this is so shocking. The lower room evacuates. You're like, we don't get this guy's a little weird. That just freaked me out. Even the disciples in the upper room, you know, they're about to hit the escape hatch. They're not quite sure, but they finally say, well, you know, we don't have anywhere else to go. We know here's the words of eternal life. So Jesus is not afraid to cut down. I mean, Jesus creates his own COVID-like crisis. And he's not afraid for the lower room to come and go because he understands that the upper room is the future of the church. And so the work of 3 years of public ministry results in 120 people in the literal upper room of Acts 1. And that's the sweet spot. That's the size of your church. This is the size of your ministry opportunity. What's happening in North America is we're counting this as our church. And of course, Andrew, COVID was that great revealer. It was a great purifier. You kind of see where people are even more when you can't gather, you know, on a Sunday morning.
Yeah, absolutely. I think I really like the that 8-year-old boy story of dealing with the tangibles and the intangibles of church. And you talk a lot about just seeing what success looks like. And even just that Jesus mentality where you're talking about the crowds of up to 5 or, you know, even 15,000 people with like women and children and stuff like that. But that's kind of that lower room mentality that all pastors really seem like, man, it'd be great to have a church of 15,000 people. But when you talk about the real church size of, in the book, you mentioned just even the 120 of like, this is what was left after everything that kind of took place. I really appreciate that. I want to ask you about you talk about the three types of churches in your book, about program church or house church or something like that. But I want to start with share for a second. One of the things in our context that we've talked through is this idea from Dan Grider in his book called Starfish Movement. And this really reminded me of your upper room, lower room thing. But just to kind of bring it into our context, guys, Phil has talked about this for a little while in the Nexus context where a high discipling leader would end up with a house church. leaders, but if you have low directional leader capabilities, you kind of end up in this idea of just being a house church and disciple making movement. But on the other side of things, if you're a high directional leader and very low in the disciple making, you have this anthill mentality where the anthill is kind of built primarily off of the body of dead ants, you know? And so just this idea of program church or running people ragged. But once you really combine the two of them, you become the starfish. And the cool thing about a starfish is you cut off a leg and then it grows into a completely separate starfish. And just so in this mentality, and that reminded me of, and just want to use that as a picture to kind of set up what you want to share about the three churches in your context with the upper room, lower room.
Yeah. Yeah. No, that's a great tool and picture of the directional, I would say you got the organizational leadership versus the discipling leader. Very similar, great connection there. We're going to use the image of the lower room, upper room. And what we'll do is just, we'll create three types. What happens when you have a lower room with no upper room? What happens when you have an upper room with no lower room? And what does it look like when you have both? And it might be easy just to draw this really quickly, Andrew, but when you have the four P's happening and people are all connected in the lower room, but there's really not an upper room, we're just calling that program church. And I want to be specific with this language. I'm speaking to 2020 to 2040. I'm thinking of the next generation of how we think about church. So the warning shot across the bow of the Future Church book is, hey, you could have put four P's together, done program church for the last 80 years and be super highly successful, quote, successful in the eyes of church leaders, magazines, you know, the best dope stories, and not really have, you know, a dynamic upper room or really not have relational disciple making taking place. We're not mad about that. I'm just saying, you're really not going to be able to do that as much in between 2020 and 2040. And I would say, Andrew, that while pre-COVID, while I was making that case, you know, COVID just made it 2030. It just pushed us 10 years down the road of what we would have seen, you know, on Mother's Day in 2021. It will be Mother's Day of 2031 if COVID didn't happen. It's just where we are. And then this is, you know, so logical and simple. If you have an upper room but no lower room, we call that house church. So this is that organic, you know, high relational disciple making. I mean, I, you know, tell the story of the guy in the book. I mean, punches out of a large mega church in Dallas, gets a job in construction, highly gifted pastor, apostolic leader. He's just leading people to Christ, meeting in his, you know, living room with 25 people every Sunday. And it's powerful. It's good. It's, you know, but it may not be as long-term sustainable, right? As that directional leader kind of element. And so we're just saying Future Church, which is not meant to be, it's just a placeholder because we're talking about what we don't know yet and see yet. So I think we'll call it something. And, you know, when we're in 2040, looking back, we'll name this last 20 years something. And it's just the both and. Don't even need to draw, just doing a both and. We're not abandoning the four P's. But we're going to have a vision frame there in that upper room. So what I'd say, Andrew, is this is organization without disciple making. This is disciple making without organization. I don't need a budget anymore. I don't want to have, you know, staff, elders, deacons, you know, pews, whatever, blah, blah, blah. This is let's do organized disciple making. So this is that starfish. It's organized, but it's got relation. It exists for the purpose of relational disciple making. And we want to see disciple making to the third, fourth generation become, you know, normative part of how we're thinking and designed. And that's going to start impacting how we think about these four P's. So these provisions start working for that unique disciple making vision.
Yeah, no, I love that. One of the things you kind of alluded to earlier was in the process of doing a lot of the vision framing, and working with churches to bring clarity to them. You briefly mentioned this, but you've talked about how a lot of your clients and kind of your confessions of consulting have kind of fit into three buckets, where the first one, like, they're just killing it. They're doing incredible work for the kingdom. The middle bucket is they're doing really well, kind of struggling with some things. And the other one, and I think I heard you say this, is that they have a really creative way of articulating the disciple making that they're not doing.
Yeah. Right, exactly.
Something to that effect. Can you share, and maybe just even as a warning to our guys, and then maybe we can kind of use this as a springboard into the laws or some of the laws that you've kind of come up with. But as you look at that and you talk about just the crucial nature of crafting words and language to move people to the upper room, but just in one of those confessions, you kind of mentioned that words isn't the only thing, and just kind of some of the tension or some of the struggle, and even going back to the need for even writing the book of shifting that paradigm. Can you just kind of share a little bit about that?
Sure. Well, we can assert two phrases around words. You could say talk is cheap, you know, but as Abraham Heschel said, words create worlds. And so there is this tension with language, and I've spent the last 20 years focusing my ministry on how is language a tool for a leader, because basically all what we're doing right now is using language to communicate, and meaning is being transferred in verbal symbols that we're using to communicate. And so a leader's first tool is always his or her words. You know, before there's a flint, a hammer, a wheel, there's a word. In the words, you know, Adam discharged his God-given authority by naming the created order, by naming the animals. So I'm never at the end going to give up on that. So you know, anything we're doing, you know, we need to, words will create worlds. On the other hand, what I've been able to do is take leaders through the successful articulation of this. And the challenge isn't the lack of words. We articulate it. It's the gravity of the lower room. It's the addiction to the lower room. And sometimes, as I've said many times, you know, I can get you the clarity, which is God's clarity, and we do it together. I mean, when I say I can get you, it's, I'm the conversation guide. We're going to land the plane on this, but you have to bring the courage. You know, I can't give you my courage to execute, you know, and really live out. You know, I just tell church leaders, you're going to stand before Jesus. What were you giving your energy, imagination, intelligence, and love to do every day? I mean, you're giving all of yourself this work. What are we actually doing? So that's the tension. And so for me, the seven laws of real church growth, and by the way, we can go to this picture and say, you know, program church, the time has come where it's not even a prophetic challenge. Every pastor agrees this is faking disciples. And we all get that every church is on a continuum of making, faking. There's more faking than we would want to admit. So what I was doing is I was capitalizing on the cultural moment to say, you know, we actually all agree now, no matter your faith tribe, no matter how long you've been leading, no matter what size your church is, like, we all agree that the church is over-programmed and under-discipled. So let's just name it, get after it. And, you know, by the way, what I love too, Andrew, is no one actually gets called into ministry to do lower room. Like, when everyone who's listening right now, when you're called to ministry, it's an upper room deal. What happens is our success, you know, kind of over time undoes that early calling and that, you know. So one of the greatest outcomes of this book is pastors are saying, hey, I'm falling in love with ministry again. I mean, this is what I got into ministry to do. And you're able to recalibrate some of the program church success. So the tension on words is, I wanted to bring the seven laws to say this. And what I would say is, it's a paradigm. If I relabel something too quickly, I don't enable the mind to make a paradigm shift. So what I want to do now is, I want to have great language to name what God is doing. But I want the team to have that upper room paradigm shift that we're doing more program church than we realize. And how do we lead from an upper room paradigm or mindset more of the time. So that's how I think about it. Words can, you can relabel a bad paradigm, and that's not going to get you better results.
That's good, man. Well, can you walk us through just some of these major shifts, some of these seven laws? Yeah. And even in saying that, I mean, that's a pretty bold statement. Like, these are seven laws of real church growth. Like, is this a lot of what you're talking about is primarily kind of North American or Western church mentality? Are these seven laws that you're saying you feel like this is global church laws of what actual growth is in disciple making, or is this more local?
Absolutely. I think these are model neutral. I think they're time and culture. I mean, I like to think, obviously, nothing is cultural neutral in the sense that I'm coming from a culture, but I do think these ideally could be re-articulated. The same basic idea could be re-skinned in any culture. So the irony is Future Church really is church, you know, but we're just naming it in our cultural moment. So I think they're durable and timeless. And that's what makes it a different book. Andrew, you know my tools well, the toolboxes I create well. So this is a more of a principle-based book than my other books. And I wanted to make it a little bit, more readable that way, instead of it being a referential toolbox book. The field guide in the toolbox book is in the works. So we'll be getting that out here pretty soon. The seven laws. Think of the seven laws. It's kind of 3-1-3, because there's a little bit of a movement or a progression with it. And it's easy for me to get lost in each law and use the whole time here for each law. So maybe I'll just tee them up very quickly and use them to kind of tell the story. We start with the law of mission. We're saying real church growth starts with the culture of mission, not worship. And I'm love worship. I say it's the only activity that unifies and transcends all of time. The angelic hosts are worshiping our living God right now. Worshiping weekly as believers is always going to be our universal pattern. What we're saying, though, is you don't actually get a worshiping individual or a worshiping community of believers without the mission of God activating first. And the more that we come back to real church growth, we want to emotionally connect people to a mission. If we're going to have more worshiping people tomorrow, we need more on mission disciples today. So we're just talking about logical sequence and priority in the process. And so we start there, but we've inherited, and we've all lived in a lifetime where you can start with a culture of worship. The easiest way to talk about this is, if you're the last 5 years, last 10 years, I worked with a batch of Houston church planters in the Houston Church Planter Network. And I would say in the last 5 years, about half of them articulate their strategy at start with a worship service, hoping to get disciples. The other half start with a disciple-making engagement or initiative, hoping to start a public worship service someday. And it's that mindset that we're getting at. And we're saying real church growth, starts with that latter picture. What's my disciple-making process, evangelistically, developmentally for the believer, and then we, church planter might cultivate, a community of disciples that, end up offering a public worship experience someday in a community. And there's just a different paradigm or mindset there. The second law is the law of power. We say real church growth is powered by the gospel, not relevance. And I think I think every year in my life, there's different ways in which I can rely on something other than the gospel. And that tendency to rely on other other things, other lower room things, to be the power source. And one of the statements I make in this chapter on the law is, I say to church leaders, the gospel is not designed to draw a crowd. Quit being so fixated on drawing a crowd. Like, you already have a crowd cloud. That is, you already have a handful of believers who probably know about 120 people in their extended family, in their neighborhood, in their vocational calling, and their interests and hobbies. And it's like, if you've got 10 people in your church, you've got 1,000, you got 1,200 people in the crowd cloud of those people who call your church home. And just do the math. Like, so what we're saying is, the most important crowd is not, the end game isn't how many people are coming to your worship service. The end game is, how do the people who come to your worship service engage their crowd cloud, you know, Monday through Saturday? And I'm wanting the leader to see and feel, you know, at rest, at peace, that this whole thing isn't about growing the Sunday morning machinery, that the beauty of what, of the calling, when you start with a culture of worship, you value the crowd cloud of the handful of people. The other thing that's freeing there is, we say the future of the church is found in the few. As you invest in the few, they will go out and reproduce their lives in their crowd cloud. The future of your church is in the crowd cloud of a handful of people who are your upper room disciples. The third, and these all kind of packaged together, the third law is the law of love. Real church growth is validated by unity, not numbers. And so what happens is we can too easily build a church, start with worship, powered by relevance, validated by numbers. And we're saying, no, real church growth starts with a culture of mission. It's powered by the gospel and is validated by the unity that those disciples have for one another, which is just going back to basics. It's just basic John 17. How will the world know that the Father sent the Son on this rescue mission? By how the disciples love one another and demonstrate such a powerful unity as they share with the unity of the Godhead himself. So, you know, very powerful. The next law, kind of what happens is, you know, the new permission era, the 80s and 90s, the acceleration of multi-site, big box churches. You know, in 1970, there were no more than 10 mega churches. You know, now there's almost, you know, 2,000 mega churches, or churches over 2,000 attendance. What happens is we start with worship, powered by relevance, validated by unity. We start taking the church out of context. The church gets so big, you know, people are driving around I start with the question, can the church be too big? And I said, no, that's not really the best question. And I asked the question, can the church be too non-local? I say, yes, the church can be too non-local. That's the definition of the local church. It's a proximity thing. It's a local expression of a body of believers in Christ. So the law four is the law of context. Real church growth is local, not imported. And those kind of build up. Once you have successful program church, you don't have, you've kind of violated those first four laws. And it sounds harsh, but you know what I mean? It's kind of like you've missed those first four laws, and then you don't have time to do the next three laws. So I kind of stop there. The most successful program churches start with worship, powered by relevance, validated by numbers. And then we start importing people from non-localities. And we're saying, this is even a bigger, better kind of church. Now, I live in Houston, Andrew. We have churches that will spin your head. 15,000 seat auditoriums where basketball teams used to meet. And now they're filled, you know, three services with 40,000 people. And it's like, okay, if you want to see a quote successful program church, come to Houston, Texas. 5 minutes on the highway, you'll see these faces on billboards. We've got the biggest lower room churches, you know, that have ever been built.
Yeah, so. Absolutely, man. That's crazy. So you, so law of context, and then you drop the other three.
So the other three, so this is what we don't have time for anymore in program church. It's the next law is the law of development. Real church growth is about growing people, not managing programs. That's doesn't need to really be unpacked. I'll just let that kind of hang out there. The other two get more nuanced, and they're part of, you know, my life work, you know, as much as any of them. The law of leadership is that real church growth is led by calling, not celebrity. And one of the biggest ideas, and I'll make two quick comments here in the book, is I really believe one of the overarching ideas is we do not have authority transfer happening from leader to believer in our churches. Meaning, as soon as God comes to earth, as soon as Jesus comes to earth, he transfers his authority, the authority to, you know, cure diseases, cast out demons, proclaim the kingdom. He gives it away to amateurs and it just starts going. But what happens in program church, whether we think of it this way or not, let me say a word about celebrity. I hope every listener here gets more favor and grows in their awareness. Some will get famous. Awesome. Love that. I want more people to read my books. Come on. I want to pray that everybody's ministry enlarges in scope. Jesus was a celebrity. Yesterday, I was with an African-American pastor in Atlanta. He's got 8,000 people in his church. I said to him, you are a celebrity pastor. Praise God. Here's the deal. Jesus doesn't rely on a celebrity. The future of the church is not built on celebrity. Celebrity can sound like, oh, it's self-centered. Let's not talk about motives or anything. It's just the fact is, if a lot of people know who you are, you're a celebrity. Jesus doesn't care and doesn't build. He's going to use that for his upper room purposes, but he doesn't rely on that. Here's the big idea with celebrity. It's a zero-sum game. You can't multiply your celebrity. So if 100,000 people know who Andrew is, you can't just automatically, you know, give some of that celebrity to Bob and Susan and Joe. Like, it's a zero-sum game. You give away, it just doesn't multiply. So I contrast celebrity and calling or celebrity and authority. Authority is an unlimited resource, and every human being in Jesus' name, you know, again, walking with Jesus, has an Ephesians 2:10 divine design. They're put on earth for such a time as this. And that's a noble, enable contribution that one-of-a-kind person brings to the kingdom. And what happens is the more the lower room is bringing a celebrity status to, you know, and Andrew, this is so important because I don't want to just be contextualized to a mega church. I tell the story in the book on this chapter of a church planner who's got a green room. It's like, you need a green room when there's huge crowds and, you know, you have guest speakers coming in to get away. But like, so it's like, the green room is kind of propping up this, you know, status that's so easy to get connected to. So every Protestant church in North America elevates the gifting of a leader to some degree. And we're saying that's that, use celebrity, define it broadly, you know, quote celebrity. Like, we don't realize how much we are platforming ourselves inside the church and how that is deplatforming or deauthorizing. That, like, we're not creating commissioned agents of Jesus every day. We are subtly, this is a mental model. We don't intend it. It's unintended. The mental model is, you know, church is where I go a couple hours a week. I need to help someone find Jesus. I bring them to my pastor who's gifted to do it. So here's the ultimate, like, rally cry on law six. It's time to declare the pastorhood of every believer. Every believer is a pastor who has a parish. It's that crowd cloud again. And how do we help them name that and see a kingdom platform where they live, work, and play in the program church, which is essential, the lower room, it's important, exists to help empower each one from calling. And that's the power of the church. And it's not anti-organizational. We still gather. We still are one family and one church. But there's a release of that in a very dynamic way. So real church growth is led by calling, not celebrity.
Yeah, real quick. One of the observations that you made in your book was just around that idea of pastorhood of all believers, you know, where we have this reformation of just the transition back into the priesthood of all believers. Like, you don't need a priest to go be this person, but whenever you make that shift in a modern day context, like, it's really getting back to, like, there's not just the pastor, or you call people Pastor Will or Pastor Andrew, whatever. Like, everyone's a pastor, and just getting back to that mentality is just as significant a shift as it was, you know, back 400 years ago or whenever it was.
That's absolutely right. We needed that to explode dynamite with priesthood, you know, hundreds of years ago. Now we need to explode dynamite with that the pastor is what's blocking our imagination for how God wants to use everyday disciples.
Yeah, I like that.
But I get pretty passionate about that one, as you can tell. But and that you know, that connects to really the unique ministry. So just if your listeners don't know, you know, we've created a gospel-centered life design process where everyday disciples name their special calling. They name kind of their what does vocational discipleship look like, and they name their ultimate contribution. I mean, why did God put me on earth? And when you see that play out, it is stunning. It's beautiful, and it's really, you know, getting a lot of traction right now, particularly in this moment and with the Future Church tools. It's one way I think of this, Andrew, is I think if Jesus were in church today and he was calling 12, you know, men to himself to invest in, I don't think it would look like starting a small group at the church. I think it would feel more like, you know, having a group of guys gather in a vocational setting, you know, and it's interesting that when Jesus says, you know, follow me, and I will make you fishers of men, he didn't come to them without showing proficiency in their calling. So Jesus is that guy who showed up to professional fishermen, and he took them to the wrong part of the lake at the wrong time of the day and said, throw your nets over here. And they saw a more productive, they saw pro when they thought they were pro status. They saw someone at that next level. And so when Jesus is saying that, he's really raising the bar on them, and he's bringing value to them. And there's a respect and credibility at a professional, at a vocational level that we don't quite fully appreciate, I don't think, today. I mean, Jesus was the best baker you ever met. He was the best bartender you ever met. He was the best fisherman you ever met. And then he calls, and he has a way of life he's going to show you. And, you know, our churches are full of people who have a 9-to-5 and real calling, but we don't see that as a beachhead or a medium for disciple making, because our program church is robbing us of that imaginative opportunity. It's unbelievable. So anyhow, I don't have time to go into that toolbox, but there's a toolbox and a pathway to release that capacity. And if we have time, I'll show that in our funnel fusion drawing. The last law is just quick upper room, lower room reminder. It's the law of vision. And we say real church growth is energized. That's the word. It's energized by shared imagination, not shared preference. And it kind of comes back. And basically we basically say there's three primary tools or things you must use to maximize the imaginative capacity of the people of God. God's word, but specifically the parables. The parables become the mirror, the picture, the window to build my imaginative capacity as an everyday disciple. Secondly, is the personal calling of individuals. So it goes back to, you know, do individual disciples dream about how their life makes an impact where they live, work, and play? And then third, it's that God dreams piece of, as a community of people who are living in a cultural moment, you know, we're living in a context, a city, a community, a town, rural, urban, whatever that is, what is our dream? What is our gospel dream over the next 5-10 years? I know you're God Dream certified, Andrew. It's that idea that we have an individual dream for our life. We have an individual dream as the people of God. Those are locally contextual and specific. Those can't be scripted. Those aren't in scripture, but scripture, you know, is a guidebook to imagine that. And then we have the parables of Jesus for all time. So that's where you get a lot of energy there. Here's one way I like to say it, just to illustrate it. I'm thinking of a church in Charlotte that has a beautiful wedding vision and their dream, beautiful marriage vision. They say you can have a beautiful wedding in a day, but it takes a lifetime to have a beautiful marriage. And they want to significantly reduce the divorce rate, 5 zip codes, you know, around where their people live, work, and play. And they have said, we're going to invite you into a marriage mentoring movement out here that's going to bless people in the name of it. And like, when you get people excited and contributing to an idea like that, a dream like that, you don't have time to, you know, argue about the colors of the carpet or when do we stop wearing masks or not. I mean, all of a sudden, all these preferences just, you know, are they still there? Of course they are. But do they energize us the same way? No, because we have something much, much bigger that's our energy source.
Yeah, absolutely. I want to go back on and touch on one just based on where Nexus is at right now in our context. You actually, in law number two, you talk about just the power of the gospel. The real church growth is powered by gospel, not relevance. And even towards the end of it, you actually quote Bill Hull and Ben Sobel's book, The Discipleship Gospel, by saying that the gospel you preach determines the disciples you make. We've actually, over the last year or so, have partnered with Ben Sobels and those guys in the Bonhoeffer Project and started bringing a lot of our planters through just a refounding, a reformulating of a foundation. They call it going upstream, like where we talk about discipleship strategies and implementation is kind of midstream and downstream, but going back upstream to talk about, you know, just answering fundamental question, like what is the gospel and reformulating and refounding your gospel in Jesus and all that type of stuff. But can you talk a little bit more, just because that's where we've been focused on the last year or so, just a little bit more about just the power of the gospel and how that influences vision.
Yeah. there's two thoughts I have on that. One is when I think of Paul's statement, "For I am not ashamed of the power of the gospel," I think for most of my life, I misunderstood what I think Paul is meaning there. I think it's easy to interpret that as Paul's not embarrassed to in the activity of talking about Jesus. Like, he's not embarrassed to do that. So I'm embarrassed to associate myself with Jesus or tell other people the good news about Jesus when I'm on an airplane. Like, I'm not embarrassed to talk about that. It would be easy. Some people would be embarrassed. I don't think that's what it is. It's, you know, it's going back to saying I didn't rely on eloquent preaching when I was with you. I was a steward, you know, it was the power of God that that was happening. And so I think there are ways that, you know, we over rely on tactics, techniques, lower room stuff. And our shame is not embarrassment talking about Jesus. The shame is like, I actually don't really believe that the power was in this message. I really think the power is in my charisma, you know, to draw a crowd. And, you know, I tell stories on that. But I think another angle is, you know, the focused idea that there's the death, burial, and resurrection of Jesus. And I mean, that's, you know, when I think gospel, most of my life I've thought of that. And what we do when we pull out Funnel Fusion and some of these other tools is we just expand that a little bit. You know, what about the incarnation? What about the life of Jesus and his methodology? Is there a definitive pattern of how, you know, this works? So, you know, expanding on just death, burial, resurrection to incarnation, lifestyle, way of living, you know, death, burial, resurrection, ascension, living King Jesus. And as we broker a fuller understanding of the gospel, I think there are authoritative, I'm going to say definitive patterns that, frankly, you know, my 5 years of seminary did not enable me to access. So, you know, so I love that idea that, you know, a smaller definition or version of the gospel or partial gospel is going to limit, you know, my disciple making energies there. And what I would say as a segue to talking about the two funnels, you know, I was given prescriptive and descriptive as my two lenses for looking at Jesus. So you read the gospels and it's like, wow, it's so historically bound. Clearly it's not prescriptive because I'm not, you know, walking in my sandals on the dusty streets of, you know, Galilee and, you know, the playbook of proclaiming the kingdom, whatever, healing, you know, casting out demons and, you know, being welcomed into a person of peace and a home and blah, blah, blah. And all that cultural stuff, like it just all of a sudden it throws me into descriptive only. Like, this is something that's describing what happened, but loses some of its authoritative value in my life today. And so between descriptive and prescriptive, I like to talk about definitive pattern. There is authority in the methodology of Jesus, and we need to look we need to retranslate that contextually. But, you know, the person of peace is a definitive pattern that it's kingdom today. It's usable and trainable and approachable today. And all of a sudden that brings new possibility to the everyday disciple and the work that God's doing in advance while they're sleeping to give them a fruitful kingdom opportunity the next day when they wake up, because God's already put a person of peace in their sphere of influence. Like, we've got to remine out those definitive patterns, you know, as part of gospel living.
Yeah, absolutely. No, it's been really interesting of just getting back to basics of understanding what the kingdom gospel is, like through some of the Bonhoeffer Project toolkit and going through that. But you know, we've been doing a lot of other trainings with I think Phil, our director, has gone through like Curtis Sargent's training. We've actually brought in Josh Howard from Central India Christian Mission to be able to go through some of these things. I've had conversations with him about some of your content as well, but just really getting back to fundamental just discovery Bible study methods of just real simple methods of training people to do simple obedience and calling them to call others to do that and training. And so I think that maybe we can segue some of that with your multiplication funnel, where we have the assimilation funnel on one thing, on one side, and the multiplication funnel on the other. And it's usually one or the other in either that program church or house church type of model. So how do you look at those both together?
Yeah. And I'm glad we can spend a little time on this, because this, to me, I'm even surprised myself, and as an author, how much this picture keeps nurturing the vision and the imagination for it. What we do is we take, whether you want to call it program church, lower room, we take what has become the modern kind of core kind of minimum assimilation funnel out there today, and we call that an attend, connect, serve model. So it's not, any church, you can't go in and see what is their basic way of talking about attend, connect, serve. And for, if you have 100 people or 100% of people in your worship attendance, on average across the U.S., you're going to get about 50% of them to the next step. And then you'll get, you get 25% of this group to this step. So you have about a 50%, forgive the engineering language, yield loss. And it's really... If this is all you have, and we call this the assimilation funnel or the engagement funnel. This is people getting more involved in your church. And as you do this, it's actually a funnel of diminishing returns, which I use to say, to help the pastor and the leader see, if this is all you have, it's a little bit nonsensical. It's a little bit illogical. There's two hidden and dangerous assumptions that is at play. And if you have an assimilation funnel only, that is that moving from one environment to the next environment equals spiritual growth. Just because you're going doesn't mean you're growing. The other and the most dangerous assumption is that if I get someone to worship to a small group and I get them volunteering in the church, that created a multiplying disciple. We know that's not true. I don't want to diminish this in any way. We just want to say, we got to move the finish line. What if this isn't the finish line? And again, this is that functional Great Commission that we started with. So what we do is say, we're not going to get rid of or blame the program funnel. We're just going to make sure that it's fused to the multiplication funnel, which is right the segue. This is the definitive pattern. This is the gospel pre-death, burial, resurrection of Jesus' life. This is the incarnation as a definitive pattern for how the fact that Jesus came into earth and moved into the neighborhood is a definitive pattern. Every believer has a place. They're a banker, they're a plumber, they're a stay-at-home mom, they're a teacher. That place matters. But the average church imagination doesn't have a toolbox to really get us there. We might preach that it matters, but we don't have a pathway to help people activate and empower them where they live, work, and play. So the multiplication funnel, we build off really four snapshots in scripture. Luke 8:1 is Jesus as the solo authorized agent of the kingdom, and 12 are with him, but they are not sent yet. Luke 9:1, the 12 are sent. And there's a absolutely fundamental authority transmission. And it's, by the way, it's the most dramatic amateur hour ever, because you couldn't look at them on their readiness. You had to look at them on their potential. It's crazy how our program church by itself doesn't bring that authority transfer, doesn't make it explicit, felt, and real. By Luke 10:1, we see a 6x multiplication factor. Interestingly, it doesn't just go boom north and like blow up. 3 years of ministry, I get to Acts 1, and there's that 120 that we've referenced. And I just, what's interesting, Andrew, is I do want, this is a literal 120 in Acts 1 in the literal upper room. But at the risk of this is so crazy, you couldn't even think there's any eisegesis. It's just interesting that symbolically, if their pastor's listening, every man, woman, and child who you're shepherding, they like sociologically, we'd say they probably have about 120 people they know. Add up their extended family, their neighborhood, where they work, their interests and hobbies. They probably know about 120 people. And that's really cool. So is that 120 people part of their story, God's movement in the world, God's redemptive dream in the world? And how do we help them learn the patterns and definitive pattern of Jesus through this? And how does the Blue Funnel Church basically exist, you know, for this red funnel activity in the world? The blue is the church gathered. The red is the church scattered. And we've known each other a long time, Andrew. What I'd say is everything I've ever believed in, anything you've ever read or we've worked on together in certification and tools, I find this accelerates my imagination for what everything the vision frame and God dreams represent. So, you know, as you saw in the book, the red funnel is the mission measures. That's just what kind of disciple is our church designed to produce. But this helps me create more substance and dreaming about naming that as the win, like helping people really engage that. And I found that the show how paradigm stuck some professional ministers can be. On Monday, I was in a church and I asked them to share their best red funnel stories. And interestingly, what they did was they shared great blue funnel serving stories, volunteering stories, but they didn't get to red funnel. We had to do that. Sorry, Andrew, on our little training, we got my 4-year-old daughter busted in here. Hey, honey.
No worries,
man. Dad's talking with some church leaders. Huh? Oh, I love your new shoes. We're getting ready to go on a road trip.
Zoom.
I'll be right with you, honey.
Oh, that's cool.
So this just, I know we'd have time to do much more than that, but I just want, like every day I'm having conversations, and church leaders and their teams are really getting some great conversations through this tool. So, and we have the field guide is coming out on this that will really get it kind of to the typical kind of Mancini-esque toolbox stuff that we've done before. So this was kind of a signal that there's a new master tool coming and a follow-up book to give you the how-to steps on it.
Yeah, no, that's great, man. I look forward to that. I always get made fun of as a little mini Mancini, or people say I have a man crush on Mancini, but I've been blessed by your tools. They've blessed our church planters for years, and just really being able to walk through some of this content. And this is, I mean, just geared around, you know, how, I mean, you mentioned in the book that every leader, or most leaders of every different faith tribe, has kind of seen just the fault and what our process has kind of looked like in making this major shift of getting back to basics and back to true disciple making. And we've tried to articulate for a while and use resources for a while to do a lot of the, what your assimilation funnel and the overlap of, or the funnel fusion that it really kind of represents in that picture. So I'm really grateful for what that is. But is there any, what's the one area, just as a final question, what's the one area that you get the most pushback from in your future church content?
Yeah, I think, you know, let me respond first by saying, I really am been surprised that I haven't gotten as much as I thought. I was a little nervous because there's a little bit more of this prophetic tone and people know me as the friend of the organized church. What people have said is, wow, I literally, this is my favorite thing is, you know, Pastor the other day said, well, every page, I feel like you were kicking me in the butt, you know, and it's like, but they're laughing while I say it. So they're basically saying, thank you for challenging me. It was hard. It was hard. When you talk about program church, it's hard to read, but they're always smiling. They're always winking. They're like, boy, you know, doggone it. I needed that, you know, kind of thing. So I'm trying to think there's not been pushback. I think where the biggest breakthrough I think needs to happen personally is that Lost Six. That real church growth is led by calling, not celebrity. And I would say that it takes some time for the imagination of the average pastor to appreciate how much calling is all around them that they're not even aiming at. They don't care about it. Like, it's sad. I mean, the blue funnel, that the program churches that we've been, you know, and I talk about the eras. And so I unpack this, you know, from the 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s, you know, to the missional reorientation. So I give 80 years of here are the 20-year generational modes that I name of how we've thought about church. And the truth is, we've been saying we can do it, you can help, come listen to me preach, come get connected in small groups we run, and come serve the Blue Funnel. And I was with Sint Marshall on the Exponential platform a couple of years ago, and she's like the pastor of AT&T, an amazingly gifted, powerful African-American Black woman who's a VP, you know, level, highest level in these. And you know, she goes to church. What is the church's imagination for Sint Marshall? Come hand out worship guides, or come, you know, serve an hour a week in the children's ministry. Fantastic. We need to do that. We need to keep the house chores of church, a program church. But they have no imagination for her life breaking forth, impacting thousands of people, you know, one-on-one every day, but impacting a whole giant organization. And so that's, to me, where I could just talk forever. I got out of an Uber in Atlanta not too long ago. This gentleman who was the driver, just great believer, probably late 50s. And he was bragging on his daughter's recent renewal in spiritual interest. And you want to know what his highest statement of bragging on his daughter, who's a believer, you know, loving God and trying to make an impact with her life. He said, Will, she's now a door holder in Louis Giglio's church at Passion City. I love Louis Giglio, and we need to hold the doors open for people coming to the church. But like, please, someone tell me that is not the highest pinnacle of bragging on our children. Like, what contribution are they bringing to the world other than opening the door at church? And I'm like, you know, what are we doing? So that's the place that Andrew, I think it's not pushback, but it's sticking point. And it's a failure of imagination. For the pastors who are listening, when you preach to that person, their story so matters. And I just go straight to Esther. Every person you preach to every day is here for such a time as this. And the days of their life are given, Ephesians 2:10, you know, created in Christ Jesus to do good works, which God prepared in advance that they should walk in them. And until we get to special calling and help them name that, you know, just talking at them from the Bible every week doesn't activate all of the capacity and potential God has put in that person. So, and I would say the red funnel means the church has to become a training center rather than just being a blue funnel teaching center. And I would end on that note, that in the next 20 years, that's one of the macro themes in Future Church. We must move from teaching center to training center. We must move from 9 to 5 is incidental to the mission of Jesus, to that every man, woman, 9 to 5 is essential to the mission of Jesus. So.
Absolutely, man. Well, I've been super blessed to being able to lead people through some of the unique process as well, and just see the lights come on and their face, their eyes, and just how excited they are when they realize that God has created them for something much more than what they've been sold by most pastors in their walk. And so it's just super exciting. I'm all in with that one, man. I like that one.
Yeah. Well, I appreciate it. I absolutely. Huge fan of your life and ministry, what's happened at Nexus, and just so grateful that you model mastery with these tools. That fuels me. I want to be the nerdy tool maker back in the workshop so that, you know, apostolic leaders can go out and use these and contextualize them where God's called them. So grateful for the way you multiply the work of those tools.
Appreciate it, man. Thank you so much for your time today, Will. I appreciate it. Have a great trip, bro.
Hey, thanks. God bless.
Bye.